had an argument in a case of Tremone Mena versus the Commonwealth, and counselor present, Mr. Dorst is present, Mr. Anderson is present. Are you two gentlemen ready to proceed to argument?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Mr. Dorst, do you want to reserve any time in rebuttal?
I would like to.
How much time would you...
Five minutes.
Okay. We will allow you that 5 minutes, and we will try to let you know when you get to that point, since we don't have lights present, and then you can reserve the 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Are you prepared to proceed with your argument at this time?
I am, Judge.
Okay, well, let's proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case is the case of Tremone Minter, in which a gentleman was walking down a street through a parking lot. It was raining and muddy outside. He was dressed in a coat. It was at the end of October. He was proceeding. Testimony was during the hearing, this was a suppression hearing on a firearm that was found during a non-consensual search. It was stated that he was on the way home to take care of his kids. Prior to the officers discovering that, they were following behind him, going approximately 10 miles per hour in a tinted SUV vehicle. They were plainclothes police inside of this unmarked, I believe it was a Chevy Tahoe, following behind for approximately 30 seconds. The officers testified that Mr. Minter looked behind in their direction a couple of times and as a result stepped in a puddle, which drew their suspicion toward him. The officers acknowledged, which is not disputed in any of the facts of the case, that my client, Mr. Tremone Minter, was not involved in any illegal activity. They didn't see drug transactions, they didn't see him litter, they didn't jaywalk. He was minding his own business. He was walking home. Like I said, they followed him for approximately 30 minutes. They then exited. One of the officers, Officer Dyer, exited the vehicle, and I believe the vehicle was not even stopped at that moment. It was at a rolling stop, and the officer got out of the vehicle, displayed his badge of authority, was arm approached in his direction, and asked.
Mr. Dorst, excuse me, and I won't count this as a time, but occasionally there seems to be an interruption as if there was a cell phone or a wire loose or something. You can keep an argument. We're hearing your argument, but just want to let you know that that's occurring.
I apologize, Judge.
Okay,
I'm on a Bluetooth set so that I can use my hands.
Okay, well, I'm just saying occasionally we're missing some words.
Okay, I apologize, Judge.
I am too, Your Honor. I assume I'm not hearing exactly what the members of the court are.
Okay, well, Mr. Dorst, you go ahead and proceed with your argument. And we've heard most of it so far, but I just was not wanting to lose you in the middle of the conference call. So go
ahead, Judge. I apologize for my lack of decorum. I should have used a more secure line.
Okay, well, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. So Officer Dyer gets out of the vehicle and approaches my client. My client complies with what the officer wants to do, which is, I suppose, he wants to talk to Mr. Minter, and he turns around and approaches the vehicle, which had not come to a complete stop yet at this point. He's approached by Officer Dyer, who's once again displaying his badge of authority and his firearm, asked to speak with my client. There was no real testimony about exactly what they were doing following him or trying to get information from him. It just said that they were in the area, they were narcotics detectives, and they were just kind of cruising around that day. Shortly afterward, the other officer gets out of the vehicle and stands on the other side of my client, also with his badge displayed and a firearm that was visible to my client. There's no contact, from my understanding, based on the facts, that my client had any contact with the other officer. The only contact he had was with Officer Dyer. Detective Adams, I suppose based on the facts, just stood there and observed. He said that he had his hands in a neutral position, but can't remember whether or not they ever touched the gun or were near the gun. One of the important things about this conversation and this interlude between the officers and my client is that he had not been doing anything wrong. So it's technically not a Terry stop, because a Terry stop is used to investigate suspicious criminal activity. There's no indication that my client was involved in any criminal activity, nor is there any hint from the facts or from the officers that they believed that he was engaged in criminal activity. And it seems that the questioning by the officer involved asking my client why he looked so nervous. They kept going back to that over and over again.
Counsel,
they asked him.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is Judge Decker. Can you answer a question for me, which is, we're pretty familiar with the facts, and let's assume this is a consensual encounter up to a certain point in time. What is your argument as to where the consensual encounter ends, and the follow-up to that is, what is your basis for saying that the officer did not have enough to conduct a pat-down?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for getting me right to the point. I appreciate that. This is my first time in front of the panel. Your Honor, well, the officer states that he restrained my client in violation of his Fourth Amendment rights against the reasonable searches and seizures. He said, I told him I am going to pat him down, and I placed his hands interlaced behind his head. Just prior to that, the facts show that they were having a conversation, and my client put his hands in his pockets. The officer said, please take your hands out of your pockets. My client complied. He said they continued on with their conversation. When my client put his hands in his pockets again, that's when he arrested him. That's when he put his hands behind his head. And there's no, see, the problem that I'm having with this whole thing is there's no articulated danger made by the officers. The testimony is that there was no bulge coming from his pockets. He did not throw anything from his pockets, take anything, put them in his pockets. They didn't see an object in his pockets. They didn't see anything in his hands. If you look at all the case law that's cited by the appellee in the case, these are all cases where there's probable cause. There's some probable cause associated with all the cases that are cited. Every single one has something to do with a Terry stop. So an officer uses his intellect based on his experience in crime solving and sees that there's a baggie thrown. There's stumbling or alcohol in the breath. All of the encounters that are described by opposing counsel involves some sort of probable cause and not just a person that has not committed a crime or is not believed to have been committed a crime. So I don't know if that gets to what you were asking me, Judge, but I think that's my case here, is that if you look at Terry versus Ohio, there's an investigator who was familiar with criminal activity, had been a police officer for 35 years, and noticed a case in the place. He saw two individuals walking in front of a store. They kept looking into the windows. A third individual came up. They conferred again, and then they walked away. When the officer approached them, he said, based on my experience, these guys were trying to rob the place. So I thought, because of that, they also probably are armed, so I'm feeling like I'm in danger. You don't have any of that indicia. Whatever consensual activity it may have ultimately began in this situation, the question is, what gives the officer the right to demand that my client take his hands out of his pockets if it's in a consensual activity? The officer was ultimately trying to control my client, to control this appellant. And if you look, one officer is standing on one side of him, another officer is standing on the other side, posing as a lookout. Detective Adams stated, who's the partner of stated that everybody makes me nervous. Every time I have an encounter with a citizen, I become nervous because they don't know me and I don't know them. I believe that that is the reason that they're using to search my client. They believe that everybody is a threat to them.
Well, but counsel, this is Judge McCullough. You've got someone who is acting in an extremely nervous manner, fumbling and stammering over his words. He has his puffy jacket, so it's hard to see any bulges. And he keeps putting his hands in his pockets after being told not to do that. So the first threshold question is, can the officers even reach in and do a weapons check if there's no basis for a Terry stop and it's a consensual encounter? That's a threshold question. The second question is, assuming they can do that, then do we have enough factually? And it's more than just putting the hands in the pockets. You also have the nervousness. It's at night. It's hard to see. And so there's a concern about the safety. And I recognize they say, hey, we do this to everybody, but there are specific facts here. They didn't just reach in for based on nothing.
I see what you're saying, Your Honor. Can the officers just reach in if they feel nervous? So they have the ability to just pat down somebody. And I think the answer is no. I think if you look at the most recent Supreme Court case law, Arizona versus Johnson, in which a person was pulled over. He was a passenger in a vehicle, and he was ultimately asked to get out of the car. They claimed that it was consensual, and then they searched him. And the officer stated, well, because I believed he was a gang member, I believed that he could have been armed and dangerous. But I think you have to articulate the armed and dangerous aspect in order to even get to that place. That was never articulated in this case. The only thing we hear is that the officers are saying, yes, he was dressed appropriately, he was dressed normally. There's also a quote that says there was nothing unusual about him.
But do the officers, Mr. Doris, this is Chief Judge Felton. I don't want to interrupt you unreasonably, but you're now into your rebuttal time. I think there was someone, maybe Judge McCullough, who had a question, but I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, I was just wondering, do the officers have to articulate the basis for this, specifically that they felt threatened, or can they articulate facts that would lead a fact finder to conclude there was a reasonable danger here?
Well, I think if the facts showed that there was a danger, but, you know, based on there's an object, there's something that looks like it's concealed, and my opposing counsel says there's a furtive movement. A furtive movement is a quick concealment. There's no evidence that there was any type of quick hand movements or concealments. It's just, if it's cold outside, it's at the end of October, and it's raining, the natural, you know, the normal person is going to take and put their hands in their pockets if they're cold.
Right.
And I think all these things are okay. I think his behavior, even though he looked nervous, he was speaking to the officers. He did tell them where he lived. He did tell them his purpose for being in the area, that he was going to get his children, that he was concerned about them, about the officers go back to, that's what he talks about. Mr. Minter always goes back to the fact that he's trying to get his kids. And
Mr.
I think
Dorsk, I will tell you, you've got about 2 minutes of rebuttal time left.
Thank you, Judge. All right, I will conclude my argument with those points. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Anderson, are you ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. I just observed at the outset that I think the appellant has done something that an appellant cannot properly do in an appellate court, which is to selectively highlight the facts that support his position. I think he's left out a number of facts that demonstrate the lawfulness of what happened here. There are two basic issues. The first one is whether or not as Judge Decker's question, I think, indicates, whether or not the initial encounter was consensual, and if it was, when did the consent end, or the way I would put it is, was were the circumstances such that the pat-down was proper, although I should point out, I don't think it matters legally. When he indicated he was going to do a pat-down at that point, the defendant said, yeah, I have a weapon on me, so that he acknowledged that before the officer patted him down and, in fact, recovered a gun. But the second question is whether or not there was a justification for the pat-down. On the first issue as to whether the initial encounter was consensual or a seizure, at pages 4 through 7 of the defendant's opening brief, he argued that the initial encounter was not consensual, which I think is inconsistent with his argument in the circuit court. And obviously, it's axiomatic that an appellant can't engage or take inconsistent positions at trial and on appeal. If you look at his motion to suppress and supporting memorandum under his quote-unquote facts, which is page 4 of the appendix, at the very last line, Detective Dyer made consensual contact with the subject. That's his characterization of a fact. Then at page 7 of the appendix, we strongly assert that a person who during a quote-unquote consensual encounter with police does not follow their precise directions but otherwise cooperates, otherwise absent indicia of criminality or reasonable articulable suspicion that he is both armed and dangerous does not give rise to a pat-down. Again, that seems to pretty clearly acknowledge it was consensual at the outset. In the argument at the suppression hearing, at page 43, defense counsel, talking about the encounter, says near the top of the page, at this point, the encounter is no longer consensual. Then he says at page 44, very quickly, the consensual, quote-unquote, encounter turned into a police arrest. I think if you put all that together, he did not argue at trial, as he does on appeal, that the initial encounter was not consensual. So that being the case, I don't think he's properly in a position now to challenge the actions of the police at the outset, but I would just very quickly say I think that their actions plainly were a permissible encounter under the Fourth Amendment rather than a seizure. The test, of course, is whether a reasonable person would feel free to leave under Mendenhall. Several U.S. Supreme Court cases, Fosick and Royer, that I've cited make clear that if the officer merely approaches a person on the street and asks him questions, there's nothing wrong with that under the Fourth Amendment. Also, the fact that most people would feel obligated to respond by itself doesn't make it a seizure. The INS versus Delgado, in my brief, says that. Under Mendenhall, and as applied in such Supreme Court of Virginia cases as McCain, the relevant factors include the threatening presence of several officers, the touching of the person, the use of language or tone of the voice indicating that compliance is required. Also, the Mendenhall makes clear that the questioning of a person in a car is materially more intrusive than that of a pedestrian. Of course, here we have a pedestrian. We also have the trial court here making necessarily an implicit factual finding that the encounter at the beginning was consensual, and we know from the Virginia Supreme Court case Malbro, which is at page 9 of my brief, that a trial court's finding as to whether a reasonable person would have felt free to leave is a finding of fact. We have here necessarily an implicit or tacit finding of fact, and the record plainly supports it.
Counsel?
Yes.
Could you jump to the pat-down, please, and talk to us about the facts and the law that support the pat-down?
All right. Yes, Judge Decker. First of all, I think counsel gives Terry too limited a scope as to its potential applicability. This is at page 10 of my brief. Obviously, if a police officer reasonably suspects that someone might pose a danger to him or to others, that can support a pat-down. And under United States versus Place, U.S. Supreme Court case, quote, a generalized interest in law enforcement can justify an intrusion on an individual's Fourth Amendment interest in the absence of probable cause. Supreme Court has also made clear, the U.S. Supreme Court's made clear, that the Terry basically is the so-called reasonable suspicion test. Reasonable suspicion of criminal activity or of a potential threat to the officer or other people, and that reasonable suspicion test is clearly less than probable cause. It's significantly less than preponderance of the evidence. I think there are ample facts here to support what occurred in this case. And counsel's talking about the officer did not articulate the basis for his actions. I wasn't quite clear whether he meant he had to articulate it to the defendant at the time, he had to articulate it in some sufficient manner to the trial court. I think it may have been Judge McCullough indicated that if the record itself and just otherwise indicated sufficient facts to constitute a reasonable suspicion, that's enough, which I certainly agree with, but I think Officer Dyer's testimony, even if you're looking for some articulation of the reasons for his actions, he provided it. If you look at the bottom of page 27 of the appendix to the top of page 28, when he was asked what the defendant was doing that made him nervous, he said, "The action that I observed, just looking over, speeding up his gait when we pulled in, almost as if he was going to flee. When I was talking to him, his hands were visibly shaking. He was stumbling and stammering over his words at times. He just didn't answer my questions. He just reverted to his kids, and then the two times that he put his hands in his pockets, all that together made me nervous. I even told him that." That's not the entire basis for the pat-down, but that's a lot of it, and I submit under the cases that I've cited that that certainly was enough to establish a reasonable suspicion. Counsel asked in the oral argument, why did the officers tell the defendant, have the right to tell the defendant to take his hands out of his pocket? What they did say, they told him twice, he ignored it twice, don't put your hands in your pockets just as a matter for my safety. I think there's nothing remotely objectionable about that under the Fourth Amendment, and some of the cases I've cited, I think, plainly point to that fact. For example, the Supreme Court of Virginia case in Jones, where the defendant, it's a Court of Appeals decision, Jones, this is at page 13 of my brief, officer had asked him to put his hands on the steering wheel. So they asked him to undertake an affirmative action rather than forego an action, to the extent that matters. And twice, even though he was asked to put his hands on the steering wheel, he started to reach for the floorboard. When, much like the present case, he started to reach for the floorboard the third time, an officer was concerned that he was going to be shot, drew his gun, told him to get out of the car, and this court upheld the police's actions. In Beasley v. Commonwealth, also at page 13 of my brief, the Court of Appeals upheld the Terry stop there and pointed to the defendant's furtive gestures. The defendant continued to move his hand in a furtive manner despite several instructions from an officer that he should put his hands in his lap. Again, they directed him to do something which he didn't do. So what Officer Dyer asked him not to do was, one, eminently sensible, and two, entirely appropriate under the Fourth Amendment. But he persisted in ignoring it. And counsel said there's no evidence of a quick or furtive hand gesture. To the contrary, Officer Dyer, I think I can find this, says at one point, if I can't find it, I know he said it, that he told him not to put his hands in his pocket, which he ignored, and at one time he talks about that he put them right back in his pocket. And here it is, page 30. Talking about he told him to keep his hands out of his pockets. And referring to the second time that the defendant disregarded that, Officer Dyer said, he did it again while we were talking. He put his hands right back in his pocket. I think, viewing that evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, which of course the court does, that suggests there wasn't some appreciable delay between the direction and the disregard. I would also point out, Officer Dyer was the only person who spoke with him. It was not Officer Dyer, but Officer Adams who said a lot of people made him nervous. Officer Dyer certainly didn't indicate that he was a particularly sensitive police officer with a heightened sense of fear compared to most people. What he did point to were any number of circumstances in the case that led him to reasonably fear that this man wearing a fluffy jacket, which he was unable to tell if it might conceal something, who was acting in an extremely nervous manner for no real reason, might have something to hide.
Well, you say no real reason, but they're following him around in an SUV with tinted windows. It was an unmarked, it wasn't a police vehicle. So,
right.
Isn't that... I think most of us, if that happened to us, would be awfully nervous.
Well, Your Honor, I think as I said about 10 years ago in the Virginia Supreme Court in the case, that if a police officer approaches me, the notion that I would feel, as a reasonable person, free to leave, I thought seemed a bit fanciful, but nevertheless, that's the test. I will simply say, at one point, counsel, and I think this is inadvertent, said they followed him for 30 minutes, but I think he correctly said at another point it was 30 seconds. 30
Maybe
seconds
the point
is the correct
is that
figure.
Once they identified themselves as police officers, then he knew they weren't. It wasn't someone who was about to mug him or whatever.
Right, and that was the one. Another point I was going to make: they weren't just some unknown desperados, or would-be muggers or robbers. They had their badges displayed, and Officer Dyer basically indicated virtually the first words out of his mouth were, "I'm a police officer." So he no longer
blew the nervous. Attributable to the fact that he noticed they were police officers rather than because he was being followed late at night.
Well, I'm sorry, what is the question?
In other words, the fact finder, once they identify themselves as police officers, the fact finder could attribute the nervousness to the fact that he was worried about police officers and not worried about being followed by strangers with unclear intent.
I think that's certainly true, and I also point out that if they hadn't identified themselves, then they probably would be taken to task for not having done that. So he would be wondering about their true identity and purpose. They did what was the appropriate thing, which is to say, "Hey, sir, we're police officers. We just, if you don't mind, like to ask you some questions." And it was put to them in a very the question. This is page 26 of the appendix. "Hey, man, can I talk to you?" Which is about as deferential and as non-directory a way to initiate a conversation as I can think of. Again, it's Officer Dyer is the one who dealt with them, who's the one that undertook these actions. What the second officer said, particularly for purposes of this case, doesn't much matter. Officer Dyer, and I've quoted a lot of his explanation and justification for his actions, is the one that made the decision. And for all the reasons that I've indicated today and in my brief, I think there was ample evidence here that satisfied the reasonable suspicion test. I think the cases in the Commonwealth's brief pretty plainly bear this out as well. I don't really have anything else to say unless any member of the court has a question. I would just ask the court to affirm.
Any questions, Judge McCullough?
No, thank you.
Judge Decker?
I do have a question, Judge, and that is, Mr. Anderson, as far as, you know, Jones was a area known for drug trafficking, and obviously in this case there is no evidence of this being a high crime area. There's no evidence that it was in the late night. It was at dusk. There's no evidence that it was unusual for him to be wearing a bulky coat at that time of year. Does that affect our finding that there was a reasonable basis for the pat down?
I would say this, Your Honor. The case law makes clear it's a totality of the circumstances test. So obviously every fact on the Commonwealth side of the ledger is that much more reason to uphold it, and every fact on the defendant's side of the ledger is one additional point that would support a contrary conclusion. I would say in this case, there's no explicit evidence one way or the other as to whether it was a high crime area. It's certainly there's no evidence that it wasn't. And the second police officer testified that he really was not interacting with the defendant because he was on the lookout for other people who might possibly try to interfere or interject themselves. I mean, that is at least suggestive of the fact that there may have been issues in that area, but I don't really, certainly don't think that particularly helps the defendant where there's no evidence it was not a high crime area. The code, since they've had no prior dealings, then by definition, the police didn't know one way or the other what he typically wore. This was in late October, and I can tell you, as someone who's played golf many times in late October and November, there are many times on those days where it's not exactly frigid. This was, I think, about 5:45 at night, and there's no indication that it was bitterly cold, or it was certainly rainy, or it had been raining. I think one of the officers said it had been raining. I'm not sure how much it was raining at that point.
Mr. Anderson, we appreciate your argument, and I hope that was responsive, Judge Decker, to your question.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Dorsk, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes of your time that you had left we started questioning. So I'll proceed, and I'll tell you when your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to speak to some of the things that the Attorney General has said. They quoted the Place case, that Supreme Court case, which supported the search of bags by drug dogs. I don't think really has a place, so to speak, in this case. In addition, I want to say that the police officers testified they followed my client for approximately 30 seconds, going about 10 miles per hour, and they drew his attention. They testified that they had blacked out windows and no indicators on the vehicle as to being police officers. And at that point, they said they determined that my client appeared suspicious or nervous because he was looking back at their vehicle and stepped in a mud puddle. So I would just say that they ascertained that they thought he was nervous even before they got out of the car and approached him in a manner that was rather odd. The officer testified he got out. He wasn't even sure if the car had come to a complete stop yet, which I can imagine if you're just walking down the street and the SUV is following you, you don't know who they are, and somebody gets out, they don't even take the time to stop. So it seems like really an insistent encounter. I just want to quote one case from page 10 of my brief in which I stated an officer's perception of a suspect's nervousness and verbal agitation without articulable facts. Additional articulable facts suggesting the suspect is armed and presently dangerous cannot justify a pat-down search in the Roberts case from 2009. And I think I'm just going to go back, but I think that's what we have. Is I think at the beginning, maybe I said it was consensual. Maybe I'm not sure. Maybe I just don't know if at the beginning of this encounter, because I was not there, I don't know the demeanor, how the police officer came off to my client. I do know that if I were being followed by a slow-moving vehicle, I may be suspicious of them and become nervous. And at that point, if I'm approached by two officers and one stands on one side of me and the other one stands on the other side of me, and they have guns and badges and they want to talk to me, and my only desire is to go home to take care of my kids, I may not tell the officer, hey, I may just say, I've got to take care of my kids, instead of, hey, why don't you guys beat it? And I think that's the case here, is that he just kept saying, I've got to take care of my kids, which I think any reasonable person means, I've got to go. And he wanted to go. And they kept wanting to talk to him over and over again and asking him these questions and peppering him with the same question. Why do you appear nervous? Why do you appear nervous? The officers never really stated any other questions that they asked him. So I'm not sure what other questions they asked him. I know that he complied and told them who he was and where he lived and what he wanted to do. They didn't suspect any criminal activity. They said that he did not appear unusual. I would just say that they have to have more than that. Just go ahead and put somebody's hands behind their head and effectively detain them while he's being searched.
Mr. Dorsk, you've reached your rebuttal time limit, and we appreciate very much your argument. I understood this is the first time you've argued before the court. You've done quite well, in my judgment. So keep coming back.
I hope I do.
Well, and Mr. Anderson, we always appreciate
your argument. I hope I did okay,
too,
Your Honor.
You did well, too. Counsel, we hope that each of you has a nice weekend. We thank you for your argument to help us determine what we should do with this case. So you have a good weekend. And judges, we will hang up and then go back into the other system.
Thank you, all of you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.